From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago, I got a letter from Scott Carrier. He's a radio producer. If you've listened to public radio any amount of time, you've heard his work. Scott has a book. He's releasing it during the first week of September for the anniversary of 9/11. And in the letter, he described the book as his response to the terrorist threat. The book is a collection of stories, stories of his travels and his relationships, and the connection between them all isn't always clear. But through them all, Scott was trying to understand the way Americans were feeling after 9/11. He even traveled to Afghanistan to meet the foreign enemy firsthand, as he puts it. Scott says he doesn't understand the answer to terrorism, but he figures fear is at the heart of the problem. His stories, he says, are an attempt to look at fear and move toward it rather than away from it. Today in the program, Scott Carrier, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may have heard a story or two from radio producer Scott Carrier over the years. You would have heard him on All Things Considered or This American Life, among other places. And his stories are often so personal or confessional that you want to know more about him. Ira Glass once said that after they aired one of his pieces, people were always asking, "How's Scott?" So since we worked together years ago, I'm sometimes asked, "What's he like?" And I usually say, "Scott's a wanderer." Scott travels around the world collecting tape and stories about the people he meets. And in the days after the attacks on 9/11, he says he felt like he had to go to Afghanistan. He says he went to meet the foreign enemy firsthand as a fellow human being to find out what it's like to live in their world. And he's written a book about that experience, but also others, from his vantage point here. Scott describes the book as his response to the terrorist threat. It's called Prisoner of Zion. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Scott Carrier, he's an independent radio producer. He's a writer based in Salt Lake City. As I said, his work has been heard on All Things Considered, This American Life, Marketplace. Also, Hearing Voices is a program where you hear his stuff. We'll mention that, by the way, a little bit later. Scott teaches in the Department of Communication at Utah Valley University. Prisoner of Zion is his second book. It's available online as an e-book, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Scott Carrier, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start by at what point did you – I mean the book, which we'll talk about. We'll sort of get into the particular stories. But like at what point did you figure that all of these stories – because some of them are connected in obvious ways and clear ways. But and sometimes it's not always obvious. I mean at what point did you figure that you saw some kind of connection? You wanted to sort of put it together in a kind of a – you know, in a book.
Well, that was my intention like right after 9/11 is to try to figure out what we should do. Instead of responding with a military attack, try to figure out some other answer because I didn't have one then. And anybody I talked to, they didn't seem to have one either. So I thought, well, I'm just going to work on this and see what happens. And for a long time, I didn't really feel like I had anything or I was getting anywhere. But then I sort of had a breakdown here in Salt Lake a few years ago. And I just, through that experience, I sort of realized how things fit together and that I was acting out of fear. So things kind of got really difficult and I started acting out of fear and I thought, that's it. That's the problem is just don't act out of fear. And so it seemed like that's how the stories could come together at that point because it seemed like the thing that was pulling them all together, the common theme throughout was to try to meet the other or the stranger in a way without anger or fear. And, you know, sometimes the other is an Afghan, sometimes he's your own neighbor. And so I thought, I put these two things together, stories from overseas, Afghanistan, Pakistan, other places combined with stories from right here at home, really close to home, as close as I could get.
There was it was weeks after 9/11, and you kind of went out. You went out to talk to people about how they were reacting to it. And it was in a show called Are You Ready for This American Life? And I wanted to play a little bit of some of this tape you got to sort of give you a sense of what you were hearing in those early days.
All right.
And like, what were the – so when you were going out, yeah. did you have all right, here's the question I want to know.
Well, I called Ira Glass at This American Life right after the attack happened. I said, I want to just drive around and talk to people about it. And he said, ask people, are you ready to go to war? Drive from Salt Lake to here, Chicago. They were in Chicago then.
Right.
And just talk to people along the way, and then we'll put something together. So he came up with that question. Are you ready to go to war?
Hate is a complex emotion, hard to understand. There's the hate in other people, and there's a hate inside, hiding at the bottom of my heart, both shown at once by the buildings collapsing. The best advice I heard was from a friend who said that thinking was out of the question for a while. But it's hard not to think. And after 10 days, I got in my truck and drove north towards Yellowstone. The leaves would be changing, and the air might bite. Air as clear and light as sharp as a diamond. 170 miles, I stopped in Afton, Wyoming, in the Star Valley, home of Olympic gold medal wrestler Goofy Rulong Gardner. It was evening, getting dark, and I saw lights from a playing field. And stopped to watch a soccer game and talk to some people in the bleachers.
Okay, I'm Shane Hoganson. We're in Star Valley, Wyoming. It's kind of a small rural area. Most of the economy is based on dairy farming and whatnot.
How old are you?
I'm 18.
So the question I'm asking everybody is, are you ready to go to war?
I think it's scary, and I'm draftable, so if it does turn into something that's major or something, then, you know, I could be shipped off to someplace I don't want to go and doing something I don't really want to do.
So are you ready to go to war? No, you're not.
If my country needs me, I'll go. I think it's my responsibility as American that if my country needs me, I'll go and I'll die for my country, but I'll be proud of it. But I'm not sure if I support the exact cause of why we'd be fighting this war. I mean, I think the perpetrator should be punished, but I'm not sure if going to war is going to solve that, especially when you don't have any specific real enemy to be going after.
My name is Jenny Hansen, and we're in Afton, Wyoming, at my 15-year-old soccer game. Am I ready to go to war? You know, I believe that if it's going to make the world a safer place to live, if you can eliminate terrorism, yeah, I would support it. Yeah, I mean, I have 5 sons, and yeah, it's scary to even think about going to war, but that's the price of freedom.
Even if it meant your own sons going to war?
Yeah, even if it meant my own sons. That's, you know, that's scary, but all the other mothers would have to sacrifice their sons too, and there will be those that will run, but that's their choice. But to me, the price of freedom is through sacrifice.
What did you make of that? That particular moment? I'd say it's pretty striking. And
does
it seem like that's so long ago now? Like,
it does seem like a long time ago. But, you know, actually, I just talked to her a couple of days ago. I drove back up there to ask her if she'd changed her opinion or what had happened. Because when she said that, my jaw was just dropped. She's 5 sons. She's willing to lose them all for the sake of freedom. And so I always wondered what happened. How did that come out? Did she lose any of her sons? And so I called a producer at another radio program, The Story.
Yeah.
It comes out of Chapel Hill. She said, well, why don't you go and re-interview these people and find out if they've changed their opinions or anything. So I got up with her a couple of days ago, and she said, you know, her sons didn't go. None of them joined up. And that her life has been pretty much the same. It hasn't really changed. But she still stands by what she said before. You know, she's willing to sacrifice for freedom, but basically she hasn't really had to do that yet. And I talked to some of the other people from that story, 3 others, and they're basically, they hadn't changed either. Whether they're for it or against it, they were the same. And I
What did you think about that?
I mean, well, yeah, I was wondering. I didn't know. But after talking to him, I was thinking, well, maybe really we haven't changed. Maybe no one's really changed that much.
Well, here. You haven't, right?
I haven't changed that much. I mean, in the beginning, I thought, all right, if we're going to go, then we should do it, make it quick and clean, and then get out as quickly as possible, because it was obvious that we were going to do something in Afghanistan. Yeah. But I was against sending you know, a full-on military assault, because I thought that it would only make things worse. At that time, and it seems obvious that it has only made things worse, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, at home as well.
But so you're driving back to Chicago, and I'm just like, the fear is a, but like, what were you? Were you sad?
I was really sad. You know, when the buildings fell, it was pretty sad, because it was such a shocking, you know, symbol. And it seemed to cut so deep. And it, to me, I felt like I could see what was going to happen. I mean, I'm often wrong in my predictions. My friends will tell you that very quickly. But I think I was right about that one. I mean, I knew that we'd respond with force, military force, and then it would only make things worse.
Well, you said, you write about this in the book, that you saw the towers fall with your young daughter.
Yeah,
you come
Alice.
Home, Alice. And you said that you figured everything was going to be different now.
Yep. Yeah, I thought I'd probably lose my job, and that's why. I mean, I thought that the funding would be cut off for radio production, and that actually did happen. By 2006, 2007, pretty much the funding for independent radio stories was gone from the CPB. It stopped, and
so you were right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still doing stuff, but it's harder
for
a lot of independents now. A lot of independents have had to find other things to do.
You know, so the book, Prisoner of Zion, I wanted to ask about that, because it seems like, you know, like the book takes us out into these different places. But it's all based on your for good or ill, your perception of this place. Like, this is this is base. This is home.
Yep.
Like it or not.
Right.
And you talk about in the book how you've always tried to leave. Like, there were times throughout your life you always tried to leave, but you always ended up coming back. And in some ways you say you think of this land as it's become part of your body.
Yeah. I think that might actually be a physical reality that maybe needs to be studied or something. But because everywhere I go, people love the place where they're from.
Yeah.
Even if it's a terrible place, like Julian Cardona in Juarez, Mexico, very good photojournalist in Juarez. That place, I can't find anything really that good about it. I try. I mean, Julian's a great guy and I like visiting him, but he won't leave. Even though he might get killed every day, he still will not leave, and it's because that's where he's from, and he feels like he'd be abandoning something. But I think after living in a place, you know, breathing the air, drinking the water, eating the food, it actually does become part of your body. And that's why people feel such a strong attachment to it, part of it. And maybe part of it's genetic or something, because really everybody kind of has very deep, you know, sentimental feelings for their place where they're from, I found.
Your relationship with the Mormon Church is interesting, because, I mean, you get this sense that on one hand you're really angry. You know, and you talk about, but then on the other hand, there's this kind of acceptance and almost affection for, and you talk about in the book how you used to resist, you know, the LDS Church whenever you could. I mean, you'd be really strong. I've heard you go off before on some of these. But then you say you sort of seems to have come to some kind of peace about your relationship, not peace with the things that you oppose or that you're angry about, but that you're kind of your relationship, your identity is forged almost in contrast to Mormonism. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's my identity. I realize that that's who I am. I'm not a Mormon. Part, you know, a large part of how I think of myself is as, you know, someone who's not a Mormon. And if I didn't live here, if I hadn't grown up here, I don't really know who I'd be that way. I mean, it kind of struck sharply one day when I was, you know, kind of angry sitting at my desk, and I was like, all of a sudden it dawned on me, what if I could wipe out all of Mormon history with just the wave of a hand by some magical power? If I could just, you know, wave my hand and it would all be gone, would I do it?
Yeah.
And it took me about 5 seconds to realize, like, no, I wouldn't do it at all because I really like Mormon history. And then who would I be if it was gone? I would really be lost then. And so I thought, well, I better just get rid of this anger thing because it's not doing me any good.
And do you think you have?
Yeah. I mean, I work out all the time. But I don't really have any problems with the Mormon church or their beliefs. I have one thing that I have a problem with, and it's the belief in chosen people and promised land. And that's why I call the book Prisoner of Zion. And I think that's what Zionism is, you know, God likes us, doesn't like you guys, and so we're going to take your land away or kill you or whatever. It's a justification for horrible acts. And it's not unique to the Mormons. It's not unique to the Jews. It's manifest destiny. It's the history of our country. You know, justified our expansion into the Western territories and killing the Native Americans. But it's not just unique to the United States. It's everywhere I go. Hmm. People have this idea that God likes them the best. And I think it's an archaic notion. It's really old, and we need to somehow outgrow it. I don't know how to do that except by somehow practicing compassion for other people.
You, not so long after 9/11, you decided you – it's almost like you felt compelled to go to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you feel so strongly about that?
I'd had a job working for Esquire magazine where they sent me to Kashmir a couple of years before that in 1998. And at that time, the Kashmir was going kind of undergoing a small-scale war between Kashmiris and also like jihadist types who had been trained in Afghanistan against the Indian military, the Indian government. They wanted to separate, have their autonomous region there, their own state of Kashmir. And I'd kind of missed it because I was told by lots of people, it's like all these guys are coming from Afghanistan. They're going to Afghanistan getting trained, and Muslims are coming from all over the Muslim world being trained in Afghanistan. Then they're coming here,
right,
and causing all these problems and skirmishes in Kashmir. And I just didn't really think that that was going to be a problem for us at all. I didn't see how young jihadis being trained in Afghanistan was going to affect the United States at all. And I felt, you know, it wasn't just me. The subject of Talk of the Nation, the NPR program, on September 10th, 2001, was the American Empire, or Pax Americana. Now that we control the world, what are we going to do? How are we going to control things, you know, in the best way, the most just way we can? It was very sort of pretentious and ignorant because the very next day the planes hit those towers. But, you know, at that time, everything was just, you know, the news at that time was shark attacks in Florida. Those were the headlines. There was nothing really going on right before September 11th. And so, yeah, I felt like I missed it. And I also felt like I knew enough about the Muslims in that part of the world to know that most of them are poor and they don't have any interest in attacking America. If anything, they would love to come to America. They would do anything to be able to come to America, and attacking them and killing them just seemed like a huge mistake. And the media immediately started selling the war. None of the news organizations were considering the possibility of not attacking, of not striking back. No eye for an eye. And I thought, well, I can go. I can get there on my own. I asked Esquire if they'd send me, you know, pay for it and give, you know, hire me for a story. And they said no. They were, I think, worried that it would be too risky. But they did write me a letter of introduction that I used to get a visa to get into the country, so I was very helpful. But basically, when I got there, I was on my own money. I had $2,000 in my pocket.
There's this story you tell about you had to check in with your bail bonds to go in, and you had to get his permission. I mean, it's kind of a long story. It's about you had ended up over some dispute with some neighbors, and frankly, in jail. And
I did.
Yeah. And
well,
and
they were terrorizing the neighborhood. Yeah. I didn't know it. I thought they were just scaring my wife and kids. They were basically coming into the house and extorting money.
Yeah.
They were drug addicts, and it turned out they were doing it all over the neighborhood. So the second or third time they did it, I just walked into their house and said, we're going to talk. Everyone, want everybody in here, sit down. And there's a guy throwing up in the bathroom. There's a guy throwing clothes in the bedroom and running out the side door. And, you know, the police came and they said, basically, did you walk into these people's home without being invited? I said, yes, I did. And they said, and did you push this man? And I said, well, when he came at me with handcuffs, yes, I pushed him. And then he said, did you prevent them from leaving the house? And I said, yes, I did, because I wanted you to come. And I'm tired of this going on in the neighborhood. I want something to be done about it. But instead of taking them to jail, they took me to jail.
Well, this is how we get to the point where you're having
this. My lawyer, Charlotte, that was the day we started bombing Afghanistan. That was October 7th, 2001.
Well, you have this conversation with the bail bondsman. And I just found that conversation interesting, because he's like – I mean, he figures.
You said beehive bail bonds.
Beehive bail bonds, and he told you he figured you had a screw loose.
Yep.
And he says to you, he says, "Look, why do you want to do this?" And you said, "After the attacks, what else is there?" Right. And you said to him, "You said you figured the problem wasn't physical; that it was spiritual."
Yeah.
What do you mean? What did you mean? It was about faith, or was there something else that you were thinking?
Well, I think that it's spiritual in the sense that we have this idea of fearing the other, and we have to somehow outgrow that. I think it comes from a realization that we're all the same. We're all live on the same planet. We're all here together. And that's like a compassion, notion of compassion. And that's a spiritual thing to me. And I think that's where we need to go somehow. I don't really quite know how, because talking about it's so easy, but actually doing it is quite difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, we can sit here and talk about it, but to actually go outside and not fall into some fit of anger or fears. Sometime in the days, it happens to all of us, I think, or a lot of us.
There's when you get to Afghanistan, there's the scene of this battle that happens in this jail.
Right.
And you felt like you wanted to see. I mean, it happened in November. These 400 right. Taliban had surrendered, and you wanted to go and see it. I mean, you had missed the battle.
I just barely missed it, yeah.
But you wanted to go and see what the aftermath? I mean, why did you go there?
Yeah, because, well, when I got there, it's like, oh, there was this huge battle. You just missed it. And it was the first battle of the war. Yeah. And it was where the first American casualty also happened. And I just wanted to find out what had happened, because everybody was kind of telling me different things. So I started interviewing people who were there to try to figure out what had happened and try to reconstruct it in a way that seemed accurate. And I wasn't able to actually go there. They wouldn't let anybody show up after a while. It's kind of a long story. But when I did get there, there were still a lot of bodies in this basement. It happened in a fortress. There's an old fortress. It's a medieval style fortress.
Yeah.
60-foot high walls and crenellations and quarter mile on the side. I'm sure you can see it on Google Earth if you look at it, 10 miles southwest of Mazar-i-Sharif. But the Taliban who'd surrendered, 450 Taliban had surrendered, had been taken there by Dostum, General Dostum and his troops, and held overnight until they could figure out what to do with them. And the prisoners ended up getting some guns from the Dostum's militia and taking over the fortress. And this 3-day-long battle ensued with bombings from the air and shooting on the ground, and the survivors of those bombardments hid out in this basement of a building inside the fortress, and they wouldn't come up. I mean, they were just sitting there, and there was no way to escape, but they wouldn't surrender. And so Dostum's men dropped hand grenades and bombs in there and blew them up all day long one day, and that killed about half of them, of the 200 that were down there. Maybe 250. and they didn't surrender. The survivors didn't surrender. So they poured gasoline and diesel fuel down there and lit it. And that killed another half of them. And the survivors still didn't surrender. So the next day they flooded it with cold water, which floated the dead bodies and was just unbearable, I guess, for the guys who were still alive. And then they surrendered. And actually John Walker Lynn, the so-called American Taliban, was one of those guys. And that's where he was discovered. So when I got there, I went down into the basement to see what it was like. And I don't know. Are you going to play that tape?
Yeah, I want to play an excerpt of this. This is from a piece. I guess you can hear this on Hearing Voices, the radio program.
On the 9th of September on Hearing Voices. It's on the other public station here.
Yeah, KCBW. Anyway, here's an excerpt from it. This is Scott Carrier.
I'm in the basement at Kala Ijangi, pointing my headlamp at the bodies of Taliban soldiers lying half-buried in rust-colored mud. This is the medieval fortress where the prisoners revolted. The Northern Alliance dropped rockets and hand grenades into the basement, one after another, all afternoon, so many it became monotonous and boring. The next day they poured gasoline and diesel fuel in the basement through a ventilation duct, and then they lit it on fire. Still, the survivors would not surrender. So they flooded the basement with water, cold water from a deep well. They poured in so much water, the dead bodies started floating, and men who were too injured to stand up drowned. These Taliban have been dead for days, floating in water, but now the water has gone down and the mud floor is swallowing the bodies, swallowing my feet up to my shins, making a loud sucking sound when I walk. The smell burns the skin on the inside of my nose. They'll never get the bodies out of here. They'd have to dig them up and then rebury them. I watch a man carry wet coats up the stairs from the basement. He carries them on his shoulder, carefully avoiding an unexploded mortar sticking out of the wall. He'll search the pockets and then sell the coats to poor people who are so cold they don't mind wearing something that smells of death. Now I'm sitting outside the building, using a stick to pick the mud off my boots. It's not working because the mud is like cement. There are 3 inches of snow on the ground, and it's snowing, lightly. There are bricks lying everywhere from exploded walls, and at first I don't notice that the brick next to me is not a brick at all, but a human foot broken off at the shin. It's charred and swollen, with a tuft of snow on the heel. I look at the foot and go back to cleaning my boots. Najibullah is in the taxi cab, honking the horn. He wants to get out of here.
Scott Carrier, it's a piece he's produced for the public radio program Hearing Voices. You can hear that piece on public radio station KCPW on September 9th. And if you're not in the Salt Lake or Utah area, you can check local listings for Hearing Voices in your area. Scott Carrier is with us. His new book is called Prisoner of Zion. It's available as an e-book online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We are going to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're having a conversation with radio producer and writer Scott Carrier. Scott has a new book. It's available as an e-book called Prisoner of Zion, and he's joining us today to talk about the stories in it. I wanted to ask you about you have this you write about these experiences that you had in Afghanistan that you can't really write about because you can't really call them by name. You talk about things that stay inside and live with you, like shrapnel. That's how you describe them.
Right.
And you had encountered these wounded prisoners. And that was one of those moments that sort of stayed with you, that was kind of buried deep inside of you.
Yeah. So there were a lot of Taliban prisoners in the Mazar area at that time. There's a town about 100 miles west of there called Sherbagan, where they were being held in a normal prison. And I was allowed to go in and interview some of them. And I wanted to talk to the survivors who'd been down in that basement, because there were 68 survivors. And I was talking to these two Pakistani prisoners who were badly wounded, just riddled with shrapnel. They were still alive. It was, you know, their arms and legs had a lot of wounds, but their organs had been untouched, apparently. But, you know, they were leaning on sticks, had, like, bloody bandages on their head, and they were really in pretty bad shape. But they were able to answer my questions, and I said, where are you from? They told me the town where they're from in Pakistan. It's like, why did you come? And they said, because our mullahs, our religious teachers, told us that we had to go fight the great Satan of America. And I said, well, how did it go? And they said, well, obviously, we've lost. And I said, would you do it again? And they said, yes, we would, you know, without missing a beat. These guys were nearly dead, barely able to stand up. And they said, yes, we would. If our mullahs told us to go, we would go. And that just floored me, to see these guys in that condition and still, and I believed them that they would. So at that time, I just kind of held it and thought about it, but I didn't write about it in the story I wrote for Harper's about the Afghanistan trip. I didn't include it in there because I didn't really know what to say about it. But I did keep thinking about it, and then I decided to go and to that town where they were from, where these two guys said they were from. And it's Gilgit. It's actually a city in northern Pakistan.
Because you wanted to know
what... I wanted to know what it was like there and maybe talk to their families or whatever. And so I went to Pakistan and landed in Islamabad, then went to Peshawar and found a couple guys, an interpreter and a driver who'd take me up north and talk to people.
Well, and then you have this kind of extraordinary experience, and I have to this conversation with... So you're there talking to it was a kind of a warlord or certainly a village leader, guy, right?
That guy wasn't. His dad was a lumber baron.
Yeah.
When I was in Peshawar, I wandered over I think it's the Pearl Continental Hotel. It's where the journalists stay. It's the nicest hotel in the city. And the bar was vacant except for one guy sitting in the bar. And I ended up, you know, drinking some beer with him, and he was a CIA guy. He didn't say that, but it was pretty obvious that he was some type of an American intelligence officer. And he said, just don't go to Deer, this town named Deer in northern Pakistan. It's very close to the border with Afghanistan and not that far from the underneath or south of the Wakhan corridor. He said, don't go to Deer. And I said, well, I think I'm going to go through there. I want to go through there. And he said, well, if you go there, don't drive. And I said, well, you should fly, and you should definitely have a way out through China, but just don't go to Deer. Well, a few days later, we end up driving into Deer, close to sunset, and having to check into a hotel there, and then everybody in town immediately knew that I was an American. I was staying in a hotel. Two bombs went off in the street right outside the hotel, and the guys I was with said, we got to get out of here. I said, yes, we most definitely need to get out of here. Let's go. And he said, we can't go back. We can't go farther at this time of night. So let's go over. One of the guys, the driver, was a big Pashtun guy who'd worked for the headman of that village. I think maybe as some type of an enforcer or something. I don't really know what his relationship was. He said, but I know the headman of this village. Yeah. Let's go talk to him. It turned out this guy was like the richest man in the village. He'd, in his company, had cut down most of the big trees, pine trees in that area, huge, really. And he even owned businesses in New Jersey, actually.
Wow.
His oldest son was running for parliament at the time, but his middle son was 25 and was named Haider Ali. Yeah. And he said, when I met this guy, the head man, he said, wait for my younger son to come. He speaks English very well. You should talk to him. When he walked in through the gate, the two guys I was with just bolted upright in their chairs. They were really nervous and scared. And they said, this man is Al-Qaeda, for sure. You know, we should get out of here now. Well, I ended up talking to him, and I spent the next 7 days with him traveling around that part of Pakistan. His name is Haider Ali.
He comes over and sits down. Gul Baz sits between us. He says his name is Haider Ali. He's 25 years old, a university student with a bachelor's degree in anthropology and working on a master's in criminology. He's home for the summer, spending his time making pilgrimages to the mosques up high in the mountains, visiting with the people and teaching the Quran. My friends think that you're Al-Qaeda, I say. And what do you think, he asks, looking at me over the top of his reading glasses like an old professor. I think you and your father are very kind to let us stay here. I feel comfortable. There's no need for you to worry, he says. I wish only to show you that Islam is a religion of peace. How have you been treated since your arrival in Pakistan? So far, I say, I've been surprised at how friendly people are here. Everyone's gone out of their way to help me. Are you a Christian? He asks. Yes, I say. What kind? Presbyterian. I was lying, again, but there was no way around it. Mr. Scott, he says, you're worried about your safety here in Pakistan, but I'm wondering what would happen to me if I went to the United States for a visit. Dressed as you are now, I ask. This is the way I dress, he says. In the big cities, I say, you'd probably be fine. But out in the country, like in the middle of the country, you'd most likely have some problems. Lots of people in America have guns in their cars. Christian people, he asks. Yes, I say, in some places, especially Christian people.
Scott Carrier, conversation with Haider Ali. And the story goes on, of course. Your conversations with him, I have to say, were really interesting. I mean, at one point he says, Mr. Scott, what do you think about what America is doing?
Right.
I go, well, how do you respond to that?
Well, I told him that basically I was against the war and I thought that we should put our money into rebuilding Afghanistan instead of destroying it, because we're actually quite good at that, building roads, telephone systems, things like that. We can do a better job at that than anybody in the world. And that's what Afghanistan needed. I said, this is what Afghanistan needs in order to change and develop.
And he took to the word change.
Yeah, he said, why do you think it is that Muslim people are so slow to change? And that was, I recognized it as a trick question, because I started thinking, well, I should know the answer to that. Why are they so slow to change? Why don't they just change? What's their problem? It's like, is it their education? Is it their feelings about women? Or then I realized it's like, oh, it's because you don't want to change. And he said, that's right. It's because we don't want to change. And that was a big thing for me, because I hadn't really thought it. I hadn't considered that. I mean, he was, if not a, you know, a real member of Al-Qaeda, I don't really know what that means or how you do that. But, I mean, he was, in the eyes of other people, one of the Al-Qaeda types. And, you know, those guys are very well educated. They're often rich. They're not like the, they're different than the Taliban in Afghanistan, who are just poor.
Yeah.
It's poor.
And desperate.
Al-Qaeda are very sophisticated. They move freely between Pakistan and other Muslim countries and Western Europe, England, and the United States. And they have an agenda to enforce Sharia law worldwide. That's, they want to go back and live like in the days of Muhammad. They think that's what their mission is here.
But it's so interesting because, I mean, you come to this revelation that, oh, that's what they want. And it's like you write about the fact that it was at this moment you realized that you'd kind of figured, oh, we're the same.
Right.
No, we're together. But then you realize, no, we're not. I mean, we're not at all the same.
Yeah, because he was talking about Jerry Springer show. He knew a lot about American culture, and he spoke English very well. He's a smart young man.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this guy, there's not that much difference. And then when he said that we don't, you know, the Muslims don't want to change, or at least those Muslims don't want to change. It's like, wow, there's no getting around this. We can't really bridge this gap. This gap is not going to be bridged, no matter what I do. He's not going to change. I'm not going to change. And that was kind of a problem I hadn't thought about before.
You say you left feeling ashamed of your country.
Left where? Pakistan?
Yeah. I guess there were moments throughout.
Yeah. Right? I've often felt ashamed of my country since 9/11. Sometimes, you know, I love America, but often I feel like we've just made so many mistakes, really bad mistakes that we're going to have to deal with for a long time. Like, for instance, no American's going to be able to go to Afghanistan for a couple hundred years unless they're surrounded by, like, a shell of security. Because the Pashtuns, their culture is very much oriented towards revenge and also hospitality. I mean, they either take you in and they protect you with their life, or else they will try to kill you for something you've done to dishonor their family, not in this generation, then generations into the future, and they will not forget. And I don't know how that's going to change. I don't know what we can do about that at this point. And, you know, just on and on and on, the damage we've done to our own country in terms of the economic situation, the money we've spent so far fighting the wars, the soldiers that we've lost. I mean, it's over 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan so far. 10 times that many have been wounded. Maybe 300, I was reading this morning, maybe 300,000 are suffering from PTSD.
PTSD.
And how many civilians have we killed in Iraq and Afghanistan? Somewhere between 100,000 and 1,000,000, you know, the estimates are. That's a lot. And our debt, the money we've spent on this war is like somewhere between $1.5 trillion to $3 trillion so far, these two wars. And that's not going to stop because the other costs that are involved in it. It just seems like we're being really stupid. We can't stop ourselves. We just can't stop. That's why in the book I talk about the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah.
It's an old story, but Disney did it in Fantasia where the sorcerer turns a broom into a slave. The slave does the apprentice's job of carrying water. The apprentice goes to sleep. He wakes up, and the broom has not stopped carrying water, so the castle's flooded. The apprentice freaks out and chops the broom up with an axe, but all the little pieces grow into new brooms. So instead of one broom carrying water, now there's 1,000. And I think that's what's happening in America. That's how we're responding. And I think the mistake is acting out of fear. The apprentice freaked out, got scared, couldn't see what else to do, grabbed a weapon and tried to kill the thing, and it only made it worse.
Scott Carrier is with us. His new book is called Prisoner of Zion. It's available as an ebook online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with radio producer and writer Scott Carrier. We're talking about his new book. It's called Prisoner of Zion. So you know, we're talking about Pakistan and we're talking about Afghanistan,
right,
and the people there and your travels there and your reflections on 9/11 and all of that. But part of the book is the story about Elizabeth Smart, about the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart.
Right.
And so I was trying to figure out what's the connection there? I mean, clearly you see one.
Right. Well, one of the connections is it was a terrifying event when it happened. I mean, I remember that morning when everybody found out that she'd been taken. It was truly terrifying. It was like 9/11 all over again. It was kind of like petrifying. It seemed like the air was so hot and still. It was just like this crackling in the air, you know. It was so sad because it seemed like at the time that when a girl's taken from a room, someone is that crazy to go into a home and take a young girl like that, that the chances of her coming back were very small. So it was a scary thing. And then also after, you know, she was found and we found out what had happened, mm-hmm, and who had taken her and why he had taken her and how everything, it seemed to be similar in the sense that religious fanatics and belief systems that are archaic. And that's why I included it in the book, because that story is a lot about who Brian David Mitchell was,
right,
and how he believed that he was the one mighty and strong. And that's something I've seen in growing up in Salt Lake. He wasn't the first person I've seen who thought that he was called by God to begin a a new church, the only true church, and then also to marry a lot of wives. It seems the first thing they seem to get from God is like, you're the leader of the new church, the only true church. And then the next one is, and you should take many wives. They always seem to go together.
Well, I remember years ago when you produced this piece when you went down to Central Utah, Manti, Jim Harmston was down there. I mean, same thing happened there. And you were sort of, I remember the piece because it kind of explored the way it started as this beautiful utopian idea in some ways and just became a mess.
Right. They split over, they all agreed there were 12 to begin with men who would meet and have unanimous revelations. They would all have revelations from God at the same time, and they would all be the same revelation. Mm. And so they were in complete agreement to begin with, and they shared equally in the governing of their new church. But then some of the members, some of those men, had the revelation that it was that they should sleep with more than one wife in the bed at a time. And they tried to convince the others of that, and the others wouldn't have it, and so they separated at that time. It's an interesting story.
it was a good piece.
It was a good one. The guys who thought that it was okay to sleep with more than one wife in the bed at that time, when I interviewed them, they were really happy, and their wives were there, and the kids were there. They were doing fine, but Harmston I don't know if I should talk. I guess it's what was on the radio then, but his wife had thrown a frying pan at him that morning because she was so upset about a new wife that he'd taken. It was a very tense situation in his house when I was there. So that was an interesting story to work on.
Well, I want to play an excerpt from a This American Life piece that you wrote. This was about the Elizabeth Smart situation. I think it's part of what's so interesting about it is how kind of it touched you just in terms of your family. I mean, the clip we're going to hear is Milo, your son.
Oh, right. He's the same age
as Elizabeth. Yeah. Let me play a clip. This is from Scott Carrier, a piece that comes from the program This American Life.
I'd seen him before, and I thought they were just crazy, extremist, fundamentalists who walk around.
That's my son, Milo. He's the same age as Elizabeth and went to grade school with her. We have a picture of Milo and Elizabeth at a birthday party when they were 4. He's dressed as a cowboy. She's a princess. My wife, Hillary, gave her dance lessons. In September, Milo saw Elizabeth with Mitchell and Barzee when he was at a gas station washing the car.
They walked by me. I was within 10 feet of them. I'm pretty sure she could have recognized me if she had just seen me. I bet she did.
But she didn't say anything, and Milo didn't recognize her.
I didn't think anything of it. Because that's ridiculous. Like, she's walking around in the middle of daylight. It wouldn't be her. Like, it didn't even cross my mind that it would be her. Who would do that? Who would actually take the person that everybody's looking for? Like, the most sought-after person in the whole state, pretty much. That's risking your life. If somebody found him and, like, recognized her, they would have killed him. Right?
Part of the reason the disguise worked is because whether we saw him as a pest or a harmless eccentric or a crazy fundamentalist, we saw him as a loser, someone to be pitied or scorned, written off, ignored, forgotten. And we don't really look at people like that. We look away.
It's from a piece from This American Life, Scott Carrier. So, there are these questions you ask in the book. Like you say, what would happen if we left the terrorists alone? And what if we pull our troops out from their holy land and let them live like they did in the days of Muhammad? Like, you know, like let them, if they want to go back to that time, what if we did that?
Right.
And you ask, why can't we be brave enough to let them test Sharia against the love of liberty?
Right.
Like they seem like such ridiculous questions in some ways, like so completely audacious.
Really?
Huh. Well, just like it seems like, I mean, think about the time with Haider Ali and you, when you came to this realization.
Right.
I mean, that seems to me to be, because you talk about in the book ultimately that we're going to have to evolve.
Right.
If we're going to start thinking this way. And that's why it seems like an audacious question. Well, what do you mean leave them alone? Or what do you mean let them have this experience where the Sharia law is imposed? And what would it mean for women? And what would it mean for liberty? I mean, it's almost like it's inconceivable from our minds. You know? Do you know what I mean? And that seems like the epiphany you had with Haider Ali almost, like that, wow, I am not, I don't, I don't understand him in some way.
Well, I don't think it's worth it to try to force it upon them, force a change upon them, because it only makes them more strong. It makes them believe. It makes them stronger in their beliefs, which is what John Gunnison wrote about the Mormons. In this is in the book as well. Yeah. In 1849 or 1850, John Gunnison came out with the Corps of Topographical Engineers, the Stansbury Expedition, to walk around the Great Salt Lake and spent a year here, and wrote a ethnography, a cultural history of the Mormons, which still is really pretty good. It holds up even today, and it was a bestseller at the time. But at the end of that book, he gives his recommendations for what to do about the Mormon problem, what was called the Mormon problem, because a lot of people in the United States at that time wanted to, you know, follow the Mormons out here and wipe them out, just get rid of them. And that's why the expedition was sent out here, basically. It wasn't really to walk around the Great Salt Lake. It was to talk to the Mormons, figure out what they were doing, and make some kind of deal with them. But he, at the end of the book, Gunnison gives his recommendation of what to do with the Mormons. And he said, leave them alone. Leave them severely alone. These are not stupid people. They're strong. They're smart. They're hard workers. And if you leave them alone, they will figure out that democracy is a superior system to theocracy. But if you persecute them, even if you threaten to persecute them, they'll only become more convinced that in their beliefs. And he showed that through their history, that every time they were attacked, every time they were persecuted, the result was that they only got stronger in their faith and in their numbers. And it's the same way now with any, not just with Muslims, but any religious group. If you threaten them, if you persecute them, they only become more convinced that they're right. So, okay, if we leave these people alone in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other parts of the Muslim world, they will perhaps go and adopt Sharia law, and there'll be these horrible things in our view. But it's their business, I think. It's not worth it for us to do anything about it. Let them figure it out on their own. I think they will. There'll be a few who always want to impose Sharia law, but most of them don't. They don't right now, and they won't when it actually happens. That's my belief, yeah. And I think it's worth a try.
Producer and writer Scott Carrier. A lot of other stories, by the way, many that we couldn't get to in his book. It's called Prisoner of Zion, available as an ebook online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Scott, thanks very much.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.